following is a meeting with disciples with His Holiness Srila Satsarupa Das Goswami, given on April 18, 1996, at the Gitanagari cabin.
There was a program put on the board. I have quite a few of them here. I can hand them out. Ladies. First thing we notice on this program is that this is for disciples of Satsarupa Das Goswami. So some of you here may not be initiated disciples of mine. So we haven't been so strict that we have a guard at the door to see your ID card. But without doing something like that, we have tried to be strict. Some persons asked to come out of convenience or curiosity, and convenient because their spouses were coming or something like that. And we said, as nice as we could, that, well, this is just a special meeting that we only have once a year. We really wanted to just be disciples so we can speak in that way. Really understood. But the other point is that I've basically stopped initiating, but I continue to develop relationships with devotees, mostly because they read my books, and I ask them to accept the relationship that I can offer them without initiating them, such as to read my books, and I'm willing to correspond with them. And then they also say in these special cases that you can also attend meetings, and I have meetings with my disciples. So it doesn't mean if you're coming and I said that I wouldn't give initiation, that this means that I am going to give initiation. That's another topic. It's better to go into individually, not in this meeting. So on the program also at the beginning, I mentioned that I would like to have questions submitted by you on a piece of paper. Questions that you'd like me to answer, or if you don't have to put it in the question, but say, could you speak about this, or please speak about this. And I say that I'll use these all in the last evening class, but I need time to look them over. Actually, though, some of them I may use sooner than that. So don't just wait for the last day. In fact, the whole schedule, I more or less intend to follow it, but it's not hard and fast. If we find something more interesting or things just go in a certain way, these topics could be changed. But as I chose the topics, there's a kind of a balance between what I call the straight presentation of the philosophy and a more personal presentation. Like today, you could say a little bit of a mixture, reading my letters from Srila Prabhupada, but I see it more as what I call the straight presentation, whereas tomorrow night poetry reading would be more personal. And the day three in the morning, that would be in the straight presentation of Krishna book tapes. So seek a balance between these kind of things. The nature of this kind of meeting is different than the seminars we just held here. There's very nice, very good faculty was here teaching courses, and I had Prabhupada appreciation, and there were the topics by the other learned God brothers, and to our classes came all different members of Prabhupada's family. And we tried to make a somewhat academic presentation, organizing the material, but with bhakti and philosophy. But now, this is a spiritual master and disciple. So there's a great responsibility here in our relationship. You could say in one sense that it's a more relaxed atmosphere than the institute, but it's also, in another sense, heavier in terms of the responsibility we have in relationship with each other. And it's not just a one-time coming together and then not having that much to do with each other. There's that example the gopis are giving when they're arguing about Krishna, how Krishna is not interested in permanent relationships. He's just an exploiter, they say. And they give the example of all these temporary relationships, that one just gets something out of it, and then it ends. And one is the teacher and the students, that they come together for semester or whatever, and then when the student learns what he has to learn, he goes away. So this is not a casual gathering, but we have this responsibility of our relationship. And partly we come together to learn topics, as in the seminar, we want to learn from what is Tattva Sandarbha, what is the origin of living entity. So we'll cover some topics also, relish Krishna book, relish Prabhupada's teachings. But also it's just to get together again, face to face, especially, in that way, demonstrate sincerely our interest in this relationship. Outside of the meeting, because outside of the meeting, you who have taken the vows, your most primary faithfulness to the initiation and to the initiator is to follow those vows. No illicit sex, no intoxication, no meat eating, no gambling. And chant 16 rounds every day. So you come to that meeting, this meeting, having done that, or if not, then having to account for that in yourself, and hope making an occasion to rectify or not doing those things. It's very serious vows that you took. But just by coming, that is an act of faithfulness in itself. Shows your good intentions to want to keep this relationship meaningful in your life. And so you have to keep yourself fit as disciples. And on my side, I have to also keep a heavy responsibility of trying to live up to at least the minimum qualifications of a spiritual master. And all this is described in Vaishnava literature. What is a disciple? What is a spiritual master? And what is the purpose of this relationship? As stated in the verse, Guru Nishishyat, Svajana Nishishyat, the purpose, the spiritual master's duty is to deliver the disciple from death, from birth and death. And so, that's what we're striving for, and that's done by developing attachment to Krishna, so we can go to Krishna. Krishna is watching us, our relationship, and watching each one of us, and we don't exactly know always how we're doing. We proceed with faith, and however, he is taking account, and it's important in terms of your goal of going back to Godhead, or my goal, that this relationship is kept as pure as possible, and that it's successful. If that's your goal, if that's our goal, to develop attachment to Krishna and be free of material desires and go to the spiritual world, then this relationship is important. Some of these topics, including the slideshow, they're based on different books that have been published or are being published by Givanagari Press. So today, I'm going to read a little bit from a volume 2 that's being prepared now of my letters from Srila Prabhupada. We're now going to give that book, it's a series, which won't even be completed in 2 volumes, it'll be a 3rd volume at least. And so the first volume we just called, with Srila Prabhupada in the early days. And, but now the series title will be, My Letters from Srila Prabhupada, and each volume can have its own title, subtitle. So we haven't got a subtitle yet for Volume 2, which covers 1969-1970. But it's mostly, I was in Boston, and ISKCON Press was going on there. Thought it might have a subtitle, having to do something with that. So, this is, you could say, Prabhupada appreciation. We hope to sell these books, distribute these books to all the devotees in ISKCON. So, sometime during the course of this meeting, you'll hear about the wonderful book distribution increases that's been going on of my books by my disciples, especially this year in India at Mayapur Festival. We have a little film that Narayan Kavacha took. We'll show tomorrow night at the end of the slideshow. And so, especially during the centennial year, we were selling books about Prabhupada. So this book is actually going to be the second volume of it, and a new edition of the first volume with that group title and with some kind of design format so that it'll look like a series. They'll be newly prepared and out for Kartik. And the devotees like the books in that way. All the devotees in the society may read them, just as we read memoirs of other disciples like Hari Sori and so on. Therefore, that's much of the flavor of this, of reading these letters, is that you hear yourself being disciples and followers of Srila Prabhupada, and it's just more Prabhupada nectar, another way to get instructions. At the same time, especially in a meeting like this, there's a kind of indirect allusions to our relationship, because this is I'm a disciple and Prabhupada's my spiritual master writing to me, and when he writes about the spiritual master and we see how the disciple is responding, there are some other reverberations that come down, not by imitation, but as instruction for the relationship that we're pursuing. I don't know how many of these these little groups I'll finish. It doesn't matter. But I don't have so much out loud reading to do. But I'll read a little, I'll comment a little, and then if you have any questions or comments about that particular category, then you can do that before going on to the next. First, I have a few excerpts just about the letters themselves, the exchange of letters with Prabhupada. I was fortunate that I have a lot of letters. Most of them are from the early years when we used to write so often. And you know, I've told how important they were to me and to the other devotees in the community. Especially in these years of the second volume, I was a temple president. In the temple there was about 60 devotees, and the instructions were shared by all the devotees very eagerly, getting the letter and reading it to the other devotees. So here's some commentary from a letter. In this case, I don't think I have to read from the letter. But it was written February 1969. Prabhupada promised that he would visit Boston again. He had visited in 1968 for a couple of weeks, if I can give him a program of lecturing in the different universities. Here's some commentary. We were helpless children, turning to Prabhupada for everything. That means we turned to him to pay Pradyumna's hospital bill, or to understand why the police stopped our sankirtan, or why Maharishi was so successful, even though he was bogus, and we were struggling so much. In the same way, we looked to him to answer our philosophical questions, or to help us understand how to deal with our anarthas. Everyone begins devotional service full of hope. We hear about the goal and think it is almost immediately within our grasp. Then we begin to practice and we come face to face with our anarthas. Prabhupada's letters contain a mixture of encouragement for programs that were already going on, personal attention to our health, doses of practical philosophy about how to cope with anarthas and with each other. We certainly had our share of difficulty or envious dealings with each other. The envy is a topic discussed in the letter, so I might as well pick that up. He says, so far envy is concerned, meaning he's responding to something that we wrote him. So far envy is concerned, it can be used only upon the non-devotees. In the transcendental world, a devotee is never envious of another devotee on account of his excellence. You can use envy on a non-devotee, he says. I think that word envy, Prabhupada uses it in rather broad ways. I guess you could call it ill feeling, you know. If you have some anger, you could direct it toward the behavior of the non-devotees. That also wouldn't be to hate them. But if you've got that in you, Narottam Das Thakur says, these things can be used. You've got greed, you've got lust, you've got anger. It can be directed. Mayavadi says, choke it off, has to be stopped. The Vaishnava always finds a way to try to use something, purify it, use it in Krishna's service. But not toward the devotee. There's an expression, Prabhupada, like fighting Vaishnavas. Like the Vaishnavas, they're not just lazy or sitting down. Said, we want Vaishnavas like Arjuna, like Hanuman. I remember once in the temple there was a fight, two devotees, two men got into a fist fight and everything. Finally, it was horrible, you see. And it calmed down and I was telling them, yes, Prabhupada said fighting Vaishnavas, but this is not what we want. This is horrible, not that the Vaishnavas fight each other. So envy can only be used against the non-devotees. In the transcendental world, a devotee is never envious of another devotee on account of his excellence. But on the contrary, if a devotee finds some excellence in other devotees, he eulogizes the devotee, admitting his own subordinate position. Such a nice, clean, clear heart to have, that spontaneously you feel like that. Prabhupada tells how, actually in the material world, it's not like that, but the gut feeling is the green envy. And the face, or the words, are the opposite that we say. I'm very glad that you are making success, but we think otherwise. And then he says, when they're struck with some tragedy or reverse, we say, I'm very sorry, but our gut reaction is, we're glad that didn't happen to us, and even somehow or other, so envious that we wish them ill. But in the transcendental world, the heart actually is filled with lightness and happiness when we see excellence in another devotee. And that should be especially true in this relationship of God brothers and God sisters. And you admit that you're subordinate. Yes, this devotee is better than me. Although in the spiritual world there is no such concept of subordination, still devotees, on account of being very humble and meek, think that way. In the material world, everything is expressed in a perverted form. But in the spiritual world, to accept one's inferior position does not mean envious mentality upon the other. Unhappiness experienced by devotee on account of feeling himself inferior is not unusual. Rather, such mentality is impetus to further development of devotional service. Completely contrary to material experience, that you're actually always talking about, you know, building up your self-esteem and feeling really good and so on. So much stress on that. And here the Vaishnava is stressing feeling inferior. But that's not a bad thing. An interesting sentence. Even Prabhupada's letters are so deep. Read it again. Unhappiness experienced by devotee on account of feeling himself inferior is not unusual. Rather, such mentality is impetus to further development of devotional service. So he's not only happy to be humble, he also may feel unhappy because he's so fallen, lower than the blade of grass, and so on. But it's not an ordinary unhappiness. It's not a depression, debilitating, but it's an impetus to more service. So that may come about when you see another devotee's good position. Now I'm commenting on that. Prabhupada defines envy as when we see excellence in another devotee, rather than feel happy about it, we feel somehow it's cutting us down, or we think ill of the devotee, or worse. Prabhupada doesn't psychoanalyze it. Rather, he defines standard Vaishnava behavior for us. Prabhupada almost always told us what the ideal behavior was. He encouraged us not to act improperly, but that we should act according to ideal behavior. He emphasized the ideal rather than how-to techniques. It's not that Prabhupada was unaware of psychology, but he was stronger on pointing out what the ideal behavior was. If we were sincere, we would figure out how to apply it to ourselves. In my comment, it sort of implied that the psychology will try to compromise or deal with ourselves as we are, or with the reality, rather than an ideal. In fact, ideals sometimes seem to be stifling us or crippling us. So Prabhupada was aware of this, that of the different dealings of the mind and the relative position of devotees as they try to practice Krishna consciousness. But still, as a spiritual master, he was not basically a mundane psychologist, but a spiritual master, he kept teaching the ideal, but very generously encouraging us how to practice it. Often Prabhupada responded to our questions according to the way we asked them. This was an aspect of Srila Prabhupada as a teacher. Sometimes devotees wonder whether it isn't more difficult to settle their issues now that Prabhupada has disappeared. Devotees tend to lose faith in authority, but faith in authority is extremely important. Devotees can turn to Prabhupada's letters and apply them in their lives now. Why should we think that his instructions would be so much different today than they were in 1969? He addressed his letters to individuals, but we can pick up the spirit of his preaching and apply his instructions to ourselves. And then a little bit more about psychology and Prabhupada. Prabhupada was adept at psychology. When he talks about the inferior mentality not being unusual, his psychology is transcendental. It would be nice if devotees who want to practice psychological theory could draw more from Prabhupada and not material theories. Prabhupada was always looking at the psychological angle. Women will think like this, or a leader, if challenged, will think like that, because that is his psychology. He was always aware of human psychology. He might have considered psychologists bogus, but he didn't say psychology itself was nonsense. The psychological dimension is a phenomenon of human existence. Devotees who want to use psychology can take heart, but they should do it as Prabhupada did it and follow the things he said in his books. It's sort of a popular expression to say to somebody, oh, you're a real psychologist, that he knows how to deal with people, how to encourage them, and so on. Person who knows what makes people tick, and so Prabhupada was like a natural psychologist. Someone who didn't have that facility would like tend to maybe just speak philosophy, but just not sort of like be completely out of touch with people in general or individual people and how. That you say something ideal, but who we actually are and how we're trying to struggle to carry this out, and you know what it's like to be a woman, do you know what it's like to be this and that. So Prabhupada spoke the ideal philosophy, but he was very much aware of, and became more and more aware, you could say, as he preached in America and lived with his disciples, of how they think. I have another topic, but I'll pause now. Do you have any comments about the letters in general, or that question about envy, or any of my opening remarks about disciples and the guru? That's a very intense statement by him. That's from the viewpoint of him wanting to be very humble and not to be flattered by anybody. So I want to improve, and to improve I want to know the truth about myself. And that truth is going to be established in my taking a humble position and admitting my faults. When I can see like that, I'll make progress. So if instead on my own or with my friends' association, I just go along thinking I'm a very nice person, then I'm not getting anywhere. So my friends who don't help me with my actual anarthas are actually my enemies, I think. You could take it to mean superficial flattery. Uh, there's so many things that, you know, a doctrine is taught and then something seems to be said opposite, and you just have to accommodate it in different ways. The spiritual master, he takes both positions. And Prabhupada encouraged. There's one letter I have. I went for the first time to travel in what was my GBC zone, southern USA, and I gave a report to Prabhupada. And he said, as far as you're traveling in the southern zone, he said, you continue it. He said, encourage them more and more. And that was all he said. That was like, it took that like a mantra, and a very inspiring one. And he saw my service or role as a GBC is to encourage them more and more. So everywhere I go, try to encourage people that, you know, go on, you're worshiping this deity, this is very nice, you're maintaining this temple, you're distributing books, go on, do this. And there may be opposition, but Krishna is watching us, he's very pleased. So you just get encouraged. Not that, you know, you're no good and you're not doing the right thing. You're never going to go back to Godhead and you feel discouraged. So he did that. He encouraged. But also he had the right to do the other. So they're both there. Different applications of the two teachings. If you think that people are saying things to you insincerely or superficially, they don't really much know what you're doing and who you are, and they just say, "Oh, you're such a wonderful Vaishnava," so and you think, "Oh, he's just saying these things," then you may regard that this so-called praise of the Vaishnava that they're making is not really helpful for me. I wrote about that in that book, Truthfulness, the Last Leg of Religion. How sometimes when people criticize us, we may not agree with what they say, but it may work on us in some way that is impetus for our improvement. You could also say that saying by Bhakti Sandhya Saraswati Thakur is very stark and extreme, like other extreme behaviors, like the extreme behavior of Raghunath Goswami in renunciation, the extreme behavior of Sanatana Goswami in gentle humility and so on, and they just can't be imitated. But we just look at them, or Queen Kunti saying, "I pray that disasters will come," it takes our breath away that you see that we can't exactly follow that and welcome insults and not want anybody to encourage us. Yes. If it's not a intimate relationship where you could really talk about that, then you just have to let them say it, but think within yourself that it's not really true. Or to diffuse it. So the danger is that you take it in and you think, yes, it's true. So and you don't give any credit to Krishna or to Srila Prabhupada. So as soon as somebody does that, you could deflect it by saying, "Well, whatever good you see here, it is just the mercy of our spiritual master." I recently praised a god brother in a letter. I thought it was genuine. But we may be also given to these excesses. We should also watch our tongues and not be so effusive to always, because it makes us feel good to praise somebody. But we should do it. We should mean it when we say it. Don't just come out with flowery statements that we ourselves know are exaggerated. And we're just talking nonsense. It's another form of prajalpa. But anyway, I tried to be sincere. I said something. And he replied back and he said, whatever good qualities you have described in me, it's coming from your own goodness in perception rather than any actual quality in me like that. So in other words, you deflected that. It's almost like the bad karma. You hear that if somebody touches your feet, that's bad for you, it's good for them. But I don't know if it's true, but they say if when he touches your feet, if you touch his head, then it goes back. So it may not be good for you to absorb this, what you consider, you know, highly exaggerated praise, and just deflect it so you don't get poisoned by it. That's what Bhakti Sanda Saraswati says. This is not good stuff. So it may be good for somebody, but it's not good for me. Prabhupada says the very rich bhoga that's offered to the Lord, that should be given to the householders. So it's like, it's good for the Lord, or maybe it's good for them. But, so there are really good things, or rich things, but, if you can't digest them, then they're not good for you. But if you have a more intimate relationship, then it's expected that it won't be just throwing these exaggerated praises at each other. But there'll be more understanding and real encouragement. Okay. Any questions? Let me move on. If you want that question answered, you could write it down. All right. So here's a letter. Prabhupada was in Hawaii. he says, so far as yourself, you have to remain separate. Because you cannot leave Boston. So during these years, 1968 to 70, I was always in Boston, and Prabhupada visited twice, which was itself a great mercy. He stayed a month one time, and then 2 weeks another time, and then another time a week. But other than that, I never saw him. Well, maybe I saw him briefly in New York. So here he tells me that I can't go other places. So in my letter, comment, I said, my favorite line in this letter is, you cannot leave Boston. I liked it when Prabhupada assumed control over my life. Both guru and disciple have to be sensitive to each other, but even more so, the disciple has to be sensitive to the guru's mastership over his life and has to reciprocate with that. Prabhupada didn't have to apologize that I couldn't leave Boston. I was his man in Boston, and I simply had to stay there and fulfill my responsibility. I relished that aspect of my relationship with Prabhupada. It was on his order that I went to Boston in the first place. Now I was obliged to the Sankirtan movement just as he was. It wasn't just that Prabhupada gave me a personal order, but it was almost as if he had made me a co-worker in his movement, although I was his disciple. He had to fulfill his responsibility to his spiritual master, and I had to fulfill my responsibility to Prabhupada. Even on the plea of wanting to be with my spiritual master, I couldn't leave the duties that my spiritual master had given me. He didn't give me the freedom to travel around with him, and because of that, I liked to identify with him. I wanted to be on his mind as his disciple in Boston. I imagine him listing off his centers and naming the responsible devotees running them. So-and-so in San Francisco, and so-and-so is Los Angeles, so-and-so is in Hawaii, so-and-so is in New York, so-and-so is in Columbus, so-and-so, and Satsvarupa is in Boston. I imagine he might say to someone, why don't you do something too, like what those others are doing, just like Satsvarupa. He's in Boston, and he's married, and he's doing this and that. Although these duties took away my freedom, they gave me freedom to surrender to Prabhupada. I couldn't go to Hawaii when Prabhupada was there. I couldn't even go to Montreal. I had to stay in Boston. So I guess you call that Prabhudatta Desh, and it emphasizes the nectar of a personal relationship based on service and accountability And when Prabhupada would affirm that by letter, it would be very assuring. Mostly I was assured and confident of that. I didn't feel like I had to go off and join him. I saw one letter a little later, 1971, when Prabhupada was traveling quite far away in India, and some devotees were with him in a very exciting adventure as he traveled from city to city. And it got a little... started to feel strained that here I am all the way over here and I never was Prabhupada. And so then I wrote him a letter kind of breaking down that, in a kind of a breakdown of that confidence. And he wrote back and he said don't think that you're not with me. I'm always thinking of you and your service. And I believed what he said. And then my confidence came back. But to have a particular service and a particular place to serve, and knowing, perhaps from time to time, being reminded that the spiritual master knows you're there, is sort of the practical method of devotional service for most of us. Any comment on that? Yes.
Principles of Vana and
Ashram, and
we kind of create
a,
Vana Sangam society.
Is
there a point where
Guru
Seva overrides, like,
Dharma's
principle?
Oh, yeah. That's what was going on in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna, the Guru, wanted Arjuna to fight, and according to Dharma, he shouldn't kill, especially relatives. So that's why it was a crisis of trying to understand. I am confused about my duty. And then he understood, Krishna wants the fight. So Arjuna was exemplary for going above political considerations and thinking on the level of Dharma. But he didn't know the higher level, transcendental level, of pleasing Krishna. So Krishna was his guru. So, at least in theory, Guru Seva is more important than any other Dharma. Generally, the Guru teaches Dharma, but sometimes he may for some reason, he may say, kill your relatives, and appear to go against Dharma. And if you stick to the Dharma and don't do what this Guru says, then you're a Dharmi, but you're not a real Vaishnava. Yeah, so when in doubt, you can ask the Guru. Don't invent some superior method, which turns out to be not even superior. But concocted. And there's an opportunity for personal service. Why shouldn't we take it? But the basic thrust of this letter, I wanted to leave with you. My feeling, which I wanted to share with you, as something that was very good for me. When I think of the things that were good for my foundation in Krishna consciousness, I think first at the very beginning in New York City, how I kept my job and earned money and gave my whole paycheck to Swamiji in the temple. That was very good for me. I started right off like a non-flaky real, doing something that was pleasing to him. What else could I do at such an early stage? But I was doing something substantial right away by his arrangement. I tried to get out of it. And then in Boston, same thing, that you know, he's there. I got my disciples around the world. I got this man there in Boston, and he's doing good, trying his best. So he knew I was there, and I always knew whatever I was doing, that's why I'm there, and I'm doing the service for him. He needs me here. He wants me here. So it's very important to have that kind of fixed position. And so it sometimes may seem to have little disadvantages, and you get tired of it. Oh, why do I have to be here? But if it's actually been given to you by Krishna and Guru,